This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Front Row on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Sharmila Ganesan. Crafts are usually viewed quite separately from art, even though craft making certainly incorporates many artistic practices. So how do the various crafting practices, whether traditional or modern, fit into the contemporary idea of arts and arts making, collection and so on? And how is the way that we look at crafts evolving? Joining me today to tell us more is Lindy Joubert, who is Vice President of the World Craft Council Asia Pacific region, where she focuses on the South Pacific. And she's also Director of the UNESCO Observatory. She's here from Australia to speak at the Gallery Weekend Kuala Lumpur, which is happening from today till Sunday, the 2nd of December. And how are you today, Lindy?
Very well indeed. Thank you, Sharmila.
You know, for those who may not know, who may be unclear, how are crafts distinct from art?
Well, the thing about the arts is that that is an artistic expression of each individual artist, and it's really very much art for art's sake. The idea of the crafts is that it's often very much for a utilitarian purpose, and always it is handmade. Increasingly, things may be machine-made now with the advent of the machine or technological age, but the idea has always been to be a handmade object that is used for a purpose.
And so where does the aesthetic aspect of it come in?
Well, the aesthetic is usually what drives any craft or art form. It's very much in the eye of the artisan, and it's often something that's driven by the heritage, the tradition, what the grandfather did, what the great-grandfather did. And so it's been handed down through generations and often through centuries. But the thing about the aesthetic is that each object may be very different, and each one is according to the mood of the artisan and whatever. But the thing about the craft is also that it really is something that comes from within. It's something from the soul. It's from the heart. It's not a machine. It's not a robot. So it is very important to respect the the aesthetic and the spiritual context of a craft-made object.
So when we say crafts in this context, are we primarily talking about the traditional crafts?
I think we now have to realise the past is the past, the present is here, and the future is tomorrow. And we have to say we're so entwined with each of these aspects that the distinction of one being separate from the other is just impossible to say.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the World Craft Council then, what are some of the objectives? What is the purpose of something like the World Craft Council?
Well, my role in the World Craft Council is for the Asia Pacific region, and my focus is on the South Pacific. There are actually six regions in the World Craft Council Asia Pacific region, and the World Craft Council, which is based in the UK, is basically focused on Europe. And being part of the Asia Pacific region, this is the largest, most diverse region with these six various regions, and these include Central Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Asia, the South Pacific, which I'm involved with, and West Asia. So from that, you understand just how incredibly geographically, you know.
And some incredible diversity is there.
Incredible diversity. And that is the role of the World Craft Council Asia Pacific region, to which I will address rather than World Craft Council, which is the European side. So look, the whole idea really is just to provide a focus on the crafts, is to build opportunity for craft artisans, to respect everything that's gone on into the past, but also to address as much as possible where the future's headed, how we're going to sustain these industries.
You yourself are an artist. How did you come by working so extensively with the craft industry?
Well, I worked at UNESCO in Paris for 3 years. I've been at the University of Melbourne actually now for 40 years, and I've always taught in the arts, initially in the education field. I taught all the drawing and design subjects, and then I was taken into architecture, where I've now been for almost 30 years. I teach all the architects, all the drawing subjects, but Having worked at UNESCO, where I worked across many countries, I now take the young architecture students to many countries where we design art centres, craft centres, health centres. I've had a very interesting experience working using the arts for health and well-being. And I've worked in a number of hospitals in the UK and also in America. And I also did the creative arts strategy for the new Royal Children's Hospital. So having done all these things, I realised that painting and the arts is one thing, but the crafts is something, particularly in a hospital environment, for example. There are many patients in bed who might sit there and be able to do a craft activity much more easily, perhaps, than playing instruments or doing dancing Right. or this sort of thing. So the crafts is a wonderful healing mechanism. It's great for healing communities. It brings communities together. I mean, elderly people in the community who have all the skills, if they are used as mentors to the younger people, you know, this draws the community. It reveres the old. It treasures all the knowledge that's gone on in the past. And it conveys it to all these young people, many of whom in very poor communities might very easily go off the tracks. So the craft and craft making and building draws people together into a very cohesive, very positive, very, you know, viable activity.
Mm. And how does the World Crafts Council work with communities, particularly, say, in the Asia-Pacific region, when there may be different concerns and different issues, different politics? What exactly is the role of the World Craft Council?
Well, number one, I would say it's thanks to the work of the extraordinary people who are involved in the World Craft Council at the board level, at the management level. And, for example, people in India, Manjari, she was president of the World Craft Council in India. There are many different segments of the World Craft Council, Asia-Pacific region, or Indian World Craft Council in India. And so she facilitates all these excellent people who then in turn facilitate all the people, the grassroots people. So it's an organisation that is very fluid from the people at the top who are doing all this wonderful inspirational administration, facilitation, and then the people at the other end who are doing the work within their villages, within their homes. And these great people that I work with in the World Craft Council Asia Pacific region, they organise exhibitions, they run museum displays, they work in galleries, and they are people who are financially, you know, privileged, and so they can afford to do this volunteer job. Mm. But it is really the people who are involved in the World Craft Council, these wonderful, exceptional people, who are the ones who are keeping alive the indigo industry or the natural dyeing industry or the craft, you know, woodcraft industry or tapestry or whatever. So it's the people that make the difference.
And what are some of the challenges when it comes to preserving and sustaining the crafts?
The challenges are great because most young people now, all they want is basically blue jeans, mobile phones, you know, games.
Yeah.
This is what they want. They're not interested in doing what their grandfathers did or their parents have done. But there are ways of initiating them at a very early stage. And having worked at UNESCO, I still work for, basically I run a UNESCO journal, I set up a UNESCO observatory at the University of Melbourne. And the idea is through education. Education is the one and only way of capturing young people. As the Jesuits say, give me a young mind by the age of seven, we'll have him for life. It's true. If you inspire a young person with the beauty of the craft, the opportunity of doing something that's beautiful, of uplifting, that's soul-searching, but at the same time can create an economic avenue. And often people, particularly in poorer countries, or many of the poor countries are now very rich countries, but building creative industries, and it all comes from education. And the best examples of that that I have seen really was Thailand, where I've spent quite a bit of time working with people like Surapi Rajanavongsi and Madam Wonpen, who worked in the Ministry of Education. They have worked tirelessly. Madam Wonpen she, working in the Ministry of Education, had access to lots of craft artisans who were school teachers. She drew them together as a band of people about 18 years ago. And at that time, 18 years ago, she had 200 schools. And these artisans, they were a little band, and they would go to all these different schools and train the teachers and talk to them about implementing craft programs within the school. Then all the village, the local village, because often these were very poor areas of Thailand, they realised, oh, if we use all these old traditional skills and we start making beautiful paper flowers for their, you know, local monastery or temple, and we start doing things, our students are learning all about science. It's all about dyeing. It's all about weights and measurements. It's all about entrepreneurial skills. It's all about creative skills. It's all about interpersonal skills. So developing the whole human being through these craft programs was vitally important. And now Madam Wan Pen is still doing this work, even though she's left the ministry. Her schools are probably now right across Thailand. And Madam Surapi, she had actually brought that program into the World Craft Council and has given it an additional focus. And many years ago, the Thai silk industry was being lost. All the old people weren't doing it anymore. And then there was this American diplomat called Jim Thompson who lived on the Klong in Bangkok, and there was a man making this Thai silk at his loom opposite where he lived. And so he suddenly became involved and interested. And as you know, that mushroomed into the multi-million dollar industry that it is today. But in Thailand also, I went with other people, and there was the OTOP, One Product, One Village program, and there is SACSET, which is a huge government agency. The One Product, One Village program is a huge government initiative where they're pouring money into training people. And now the Thai craft industry is worth well over $1 billion a year.
Right.
And that was an industry that really had almost died.
And it's also a great example of how a particular community can actually take charge or empower themselves rather than wait for someone, or rather than to have someone from a different country or a different culture, typically, you know, sort of a Western to Eastern kind of model, which used to be practiced. But your story sounds like something that works from within the community.
It's one of the most important things. It's something I learned at UNESCO. It's very easy for Western people with their know-how and sophistication to come in and tell people what to do. It's the same in the health industry. If people come into a community or a group of people who are suffering, say, young people with drug problems or whatever, some expert comes in and tells them, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. It's great while you're doing the workshop or you're doing that immediate program. But once the program's over and we say the circus has left town, what's left? You know, they're left in tatters. All their dreams and ambitions were raised, and then they find they just didn't have the know-how or the wherewithal to continue with it. So it's critical that people take ownership of all these programs. And that's something Madam Wan Pen, working from the ground with the local people, teaching them the skills that were very much embedded in their society anyway. And that is, people must take ownership. And that's with the World Health Organizations, with UNESCO, it's with any UN agency. The ones that succeed are the ones where it comes from within. And it's very much the women in a community who are the ones that strive to keep their families together, strive to keep, you know, the economics going. And women are often a very strong driver, you know, and the women often go unnoticed. But it can be often the women who keep these things operational and going into the future.
Well, on that note, we do need to take a break. But when we come back, we'll speak more about the sustainability of the crafts industries. I'm speaking to Lindy Joubert, Vice President of the World Craft Council, Asia Pacific region, focusing on the South Pacific, and founding director of the UNESCO Observatory. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Front Row on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Sharmila Ganesan. I'm speaking to Lindy Joubert, Vice President of the World Craft Council Asia Pacific, where she focuses on the South Pacific, and founding director of the UNESCO Observatory. She's here to speak at the Gallery Weekend Kuala Lumpur, which is happening from today till Sunday, the 2nd of December, where she'll be speaking about the role of crafts within the contemporary art practice. So, Lindy, before we went on break, we were speaking a little bit about how important it is to make the craft industries self-sustaining and sustainable within their communities. What are some of the sustainability initiatives that you've personally worked on or been involved with?
Well, having worked at UNESCO, I would say, and now working with my students in the Faculty of Architecture at the University of Melbourne, where we go off and design buildings for craftspeople or for artisans, we do art galleries, we've done health centres, we've done a number of things. We've done a Persian cultural centre, we've done a Sami cultural centre up in Lapland, we've done a number of things in the Cook Islands, Papua New Guinea, India, various places. And I would say that once you've designed a space where people feel calm, where they feel comfortable, where it's culturally appropriate, that is a very good start. Trying to do things in a bare room that, you know, has no soul, no warmth. I think the idea of space and place is absolutely critical for a group of people to feel comfortable and to get a creative inspiration. So you say, how can it become sustainable? Well, I spoke to you earlier where I say it's only through education that you can sustain the idea of long-term craft industries. You've got to embed it at an early age, and you've got to keep that lifelong learning going. You've got to train the trainers. You've got to constantly upgrade skills. You've got to work with communities. You've got to work with the elders. You've got to work with the people who are experts and bring those experts into schools. Mm. And into workshops and into learning situations so that people have the best advice from the very, very best people. So the idea is to honour not only the old people of that one's community, but to also honour the expertise of wonderful young people and, well, not necessarily young, middle-aged people, old people, but just people who've devoted a lifetime to developing skills and knowledge. So knowledge is the key. And that's the sustaining thing, you know, for absolutely everything we do. But the other thing is we can't rely necessarily on governments always to give funding. I have the role of working across the South Pacific, and it's very difficult. It's very diverse. It's a huge region, thousands of islands, and it's very difficult to draw on all these groups. But New Zealand functions very well as a main motivating force across the Pacific. And New Zealand has a magnificent arts council where they spend a lot of money supporting the arts and the crafts. And I would say New Zealand is one of the best examples. And they had this wonderful new strategy for the next 4 or 5 years. And in it, they're talking constantly about, you know, becoming self-sustaining, using a little bit of money to build greater money. So you have to train people, you have to provide the right spaces, you have to use experts. It's all the things I'm saying. But often easier said than done, you say. In Australia, we do not have the support from the government. We had support and it's been taken away. And now the new director at the National Gallery Australia is wanting to put back into place a director or a curator of the crafts. So sustaining things for the future is very much who's in charge and what each person in charge, what their particular interests are. So I think the idea is for people to understand you can't expect handouts all the time. I think if government agencies or larger agencies are going to give money, it's money that must bring in massive returns. It must not be money that goes into the ether and just disappears. Mm. So the idea of supporting small-time industries, of supporting women who are very, very good at managing money and building up industries, that's very, very, a very, very good thing. But for sustaining craft, I think we have to look at what the future is. Mm-hmm. The future is now. IT is growing at an exponential rate. and we don't know where it's going to head. We have absolutely no idea what the jobs of the future are all about. And already there are massive leaps and bounds in 3D modelling, creating objects that have been completely modelled on computers.
Yeah.
And the beauty of these objects is fabulous. But we also have to respect the handmade. And my dear friend, Raja Fuzia, who was a former World Craft Council president and is here in Malaysia and does enormous work for the crafts here in KL and across Malaysia, she said, Lindy, don't forget the soul. It's all about the soul and the heart and the spirit. And that's where it is. It's a spiritual thing that comes through the crafts. So we have to look deep within ourselves, and we have to sort of think deeply about, you know, how we feel most deeply and passionately about everything that we do. So craft stakeholders are deeply invested in where we're going and what the sustainability of crafts is.
Of course, when we talk about sustainability, one of the things that comes to mind is, of course, we are working with communities that are of different levels of empowerment, that are in different stages when it comes to their access to things like education, to things like even economic sustainability, for instance. How do you ensure that their interests are protected? That that in this rush to make the crafts accessible to the rest of the world, or to build an industry around a practice that is, you know, centuries old in some case, that the artisans themselves are not being taken advantage of?
Well, tragically, this is a very real situation. When I was living in Paris, I knew a man who would go to Africa, and he has actually, the traditional finest pieces of African crafts have basically been sold by dealers. And all that exists now are very poor copies and imitations. And there are people who've absolutely exploited this. And when I was also at UNESCO, there was a whole division talking about intellectual property. And so there are very, you know, enormous amount of research and investigation and documentation about preserving the intellectual rights of people and artisans. Now, this is where museums come in, because museums are the, run by people who are very knowledgeable and great, have a great eye and have a very intimate relationship with the people who are the makers. And they do collect, you know, the best of each country's artifacts and, you know, objects. And so museums, galleries run, a very, very, very important role in the collection of, the traditional and the contemporary arts and crafts. So in Australia, our new World Craft Council Australia organisation is actually trying to inform artisans what their rights are, you know, not to let things go, not to sell it for nothing, always to value their work and give it a good price, and to give a sort of a documented analysis of what they should expect as artisans, so they don't lose what they do, or it isn't copied, or it doesn't go into the Chinese market and it's mass produced. So it's very difficult to monitor these things, but artisans do need to be made aware of their special contribution to the world, and it really does need to be nurtured and supported.
I think that's actually part of the challenge, right? That for communities that have been, that have these crafts incorporated into their daily lives for, you know, centuries, as we said, they may not actually realize the value or just how special what they're doing is. How does that happen? How do you make them aware of this?
Well, a very good example here is Australian Indigenous art, because Indigenous art in Australia is unique. It's magnificent. It's very beautiful. Each area of the, you know, there are so many different languages and expectations and histories within Indigenous culture, and each one has their own very special art form. And for years or centuries, over 40,000 centuries. They've been doing these art forms. And it has only been really in this last, 50 years that their work has become appreciated. And, of course, there was a lot of unscrupulous dealing where people would take it and then have it mass-produced in Bali or in China or whatever. But there's such an emphasis now, particularly with Musée d'Orsay in Paris, and, the Oceanic wonderful exhibition that's just been on, or it's currently on, yeah, at the Royal Academy. There are very great curators who are appreciating all this work and giving it great credence, and, it's becoming extremely valuable. Mm. Now, you ask about the artisans. Yes, I mean, there's a man up in the north of Australia, Alec Tapoti, makes the most incredible headdresses. They're just beyond belief how intricate and interesting and detailed they are. And they've done this for centuries, and now they are such specialised art forms. And I wanted to take one or two of these to one of our World Craft Council Award of Excellence. But when I spoke to the man who was more or less Alec Tapoti's manager, he just said, look, they're too precious. We can't take them out of the country. Mm. So there are so many angles. I mean, they're so precious you can't expose them. But on the other hand, they are being very well protected and cared for.
And when it comes to what you talked about, which is curating the crafts or, putting them in a museum setting or a gallery setting, does it require an approach that is different from what an expert would typically do when it comes to the art market?
Well, yes, it's different in a way because artists have a history of exhibiting their work, mm, and it's always seen as a beautiful, pure art form. And so this has been the tradition for, centuries, that artists are always displaying their work in galleries. And the utensil, the everyday object, it's only recently that we have this emphasis on craft as a sort of a form that is appreciated for its beauty. I mean, there are so many different crafts that, boat building is a craft. We think of, tapestry, we think of woodwork, we think of, there are so many ceramics, there are so many different crafts, but these often were just utilitarian products.
Right.
They were never exhibited. Mm. Europe has had a very much more sophisticated approach to exhibiting craft works. People now realise that the crafts are just as valuable, and it's very much the work of the World Craft Council and the World Craft Council Asia Pacific region, who are valuing the crafts, who are giving it the focus, who are having exhibitions all around the world. Wonderful people like Edric Ong. He's a genius. He is an absolute genius. You might know of Edric Ong. He's a unique, magnificent individual who's devoted his life to the crafts, and he has exhibitions in Paris, in London, in America, all around the place. And his craft works have become such unique art forms, and he's such an exponent of supporting artisans. He goes deep into the, jungle in Sarawak and, draws in all the people who are making wonderful products, and he takes them to the world stage. He goes to Santa Fe Craft Fair every 2 years, and he has these fabulous exhibitions. And he's having one with Manjuri, who was the World Craft Council India president, and she and Edric were famously together. Mm-hmm. And they have one exhibition after another, the Tree of Life. They're about to have a hat exhibition with the headdresses and the wonderful hats and turbans called Hats Off. And they're fabulous people for doing all this work. And it's thanks to the World Craft Council, mm-hmm, which is an organisation that's been going for over 50 years, but we hope it's becoming increasingly well known and people take more interest in it.
So what kind of expertise or knowledge or appreciation are we talking about when we talk about learning to appreciate crafts? Because I think perhaps when you're talking about appreciating art, because it's an aesthetic sort of appreciation, whereas when it comes to craft, you're also talking about being able to recognize the work that's gone into it, the history. And I think that can be a little bit more complex, isn't it?
It's quite an issue, actually, because I'm thinking of the work of a wonderful craft maker in Melbourne called Vicky Mason, and she makes these extraordinary brooches and jewellery, and she spends months making some of these. And she has exhibitions, yes, and she is in various, you know, museums and displays. But for the time and that she puts into it, although they're quite expensive to buy from my perspective, they are very inexpensive for the number of hours she has actually put into it. So that is the problem. When you're on a sort of making a lot of ceramics, yes, you make a lot and it's a bit of a production line. But there are many artisans like Vicky who do exquisite work that is very time consuming and it's financially just not rewarding in the least.
Right.
And it's not really accessible to a lot of people because it's probably still out of the price range of most people. So there's this terrible dilemma. How do we support the unique and contemporary artisan who has ideas that are so way beyond the past, but at the same time allow them to have a decent living? Mm. So the idea of creating economic industries, creative industries, when there's a lot of support, when there's a lot of it being made, yes, you have more access to markets. But the individual things are not as accessible.
When it comes to the idea of buying or collecting crafts, how does the market generally respond? Is there a sort of standard or you know, is there fair consideration given to what the craft is?
Well, it's all about knowledge and education, really. Once you know what has gone into the making of an object, yes, you can appreciate it. And I see objects. I've just bought a little dish from Bali, you know, which is made out of the abalone shell. The same dish or the same object is made in Korea. The Korean one is extremely expensive. The one in Bali is very inexpensive, but they're very, very similar. So, you know, it really is just a matter of standards and appreciation and access. I mean, where trade costs are so much more in one country and so limited and little in another country. So the variations constantly are in conflict and there's no standard rule wherever you go for anything. Mm-hmm. I think we just have to realize the world is so diverse. It's so different wherever you are. And we tried to. You cannot standardize anything. There are, you know, attempts to standardize, you know, expectations of buyers and curators, etc. And I think it's really the curators in galleries who are the ones in the best position for having the money, being able to buy very superb and unique products and putting them on display in museums and galleries. But for the average person, a lot of these things, I mean, when you think, go back centuries to all the beautiful French products or English products or exquisite jewellery and plates and ornamentations, yes, they are appreciated. And we look at them today and we think, how could this have ever been made? Well, the same thing applies today. There are extraordinary things that are being made. And if they're very expensive, it's not for the normal everyday person. It has to be for the very wealthy philanthropist or it has to be for galleries. Mm-hmm. But when I spoke about Alec Tipote's headdresses, they're priceless.
Right.
They're totally priceless.
Yeah. How can the average person cultivate their appreciation for the crafts and support craft industries, but in a way that is sustainable and does contribute to growing it?
Well, I would say that through organisations like the World Craft Council in the Asia-Pacific region, through craft fairs, all the activities that are going on around the world, it's a very good idea to look at the World Craft Council Asia-Pacific region website, and you would be amazed at the number of craft fairs, activities, workshops, exhibitions that are going on. So it's a wonderful website. If your listeners are interested, please have a look because they're very precise and detailed and comprehensive, putting up on a regular basis all the activities that are going on. But it is really through, there are craft magazines, of course, and there are wonderful craft museums around the world, Victoria and Albert, you know, incredible museums, Metropolitan Museum, the National Gallery of Australia are now about to employ a new director in craft. So there is a growing awareness of craft as a wonderful art form that can be collected for its own sake. Mm-hmm. But the whole concept of craft has always been as a handmade utilitarian object. Mm-hmm. But we need to be flexible and fluid, yeah, because there are many answers to many different aspects of this.
I suppose one answer would be perhaps to also be aware that, say, when we travel, for instance, to purchase from artisans and to purchase from ethically established organizations rather than cheap reproductions, for instance.
There are some wonderful markets where Santa Fe is the best in the world because they've been well selected. The artisans are the best in their field. They all come together. They had 150 artisans this year in Santa Fe. But not everyone can go to Santa Fe. So in Australia, we do have wonderful craft markets. We have many, many craft markets. I know America does. I think many countries around all across Europe. But in the Pacific, for example, you might have the little craft markets, but mostly all their objects are, you know, used everyday life. They don't value them like we value them. Okay. So it's a very complicated and diverse sort of response. I can't give you a very specific thing, but buying from artisans who make the object themselves, where you look for a bit of individuality, you look for that quirky approach, or you look for something that's just beautiful and aesthetically pleasing, it's always that interaction through one person and another. That's the beauty of craft. Mm-hmm. We are always talking to the artisan. We're always talking to the maker.
Yep.
And that's something that you don't buy in a shop. You know, you don't go to a supermarket or you don't go to a big shopping mall and buy a beautiful craft object. You usually buy it directly from the artisan. Mm-hmm. Or there are some lovely little gallery shops. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much, Lindy.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Shamila.
I've been speaking to Lindy Joubert, Vice President of the World Craft Council Asia Pacific region, where she focuses on the South Pacific. She's also founding director of the UNESCO Observatory, and she's here to present a session called Handmade for This Century at the Gallery Weekend Kuala Lumpur, which is on from today till Sunday, the 2nd of December. For more information, visit gw-kl.com. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Front Row segments, you can download the podcasts on our BFM app. You've been listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.